for those of us who voted for the Affordable Care Act, we wrote the statute so that it was clear, but that we designed the statute so that it only works if the subsidies go to both federal and state-based exchanges. If this court was to substitute their judgment and their interpretation of intent for that of Congress, it would throw the law into pandemonium, because it wouldn't just affect people with subsidies. It would affect everyone else. You cannot maintain the insurance protection in states with federal exchanges without the subsidy. Thus, the entirety of the statute falls into disarray in over half of the country. And it's too bad, because this should be a week in which we're celebrating the success of the Affordable Care Act. With the end of the first open enrollment period and special enrollment period, we now know that 11.6 million Americans have signed up for exchanges all across the country, and another 10 million Americans are enrolled in Medicaid plans because of the Affordable Care Act. That means there are 20 million Americans who now have health care because of the Affordable Care Act, a decrease in the uninsurance rate all across the country of 25%. In my state of Connecticut, we've decreased the uninsurance rate by 50%. Now is the time to be heralding those successes, building upon the success of the Affordable Care Act. I would be stunned if the Supreme Court invalidated this law based on the King v. Burwell decision. I think the plaintiff's case is flimsy at best, and that's the reason why only a handful of Republican attorney generals even signed on to this case in the first place. The reason why the American Hospital Association and medical groups all across the country are lobbying against it, and I'm pleased to be joined on the call by both Senator Merkley and Senator Schumer. I'll turn it over to Senator Merkley.
Well, hello, everyone. The ACA is working very well in the state of Oregon, as it is across the country. We have more than 500,000 Oregonians who have accessed health care as a result of Medicaid expansion and the state exchange, and far more who have benefited from other provisions, including preventative care, and the ban on folks being turned away for pre-existing conditions. Not to mention the rebates folks have gotten under the 80-20 rule, and the children who have been able to be on their parents' policies. But focusing in on the heart of this, I was struck by a woman who came up to me at a fundraiser for multiple sclerosis. And she said, "Senator, things are so much different now than they were before." And I said, "Well, how so?" And she said, "In our multiple sclerosis community, if you have a loved one who is struck by this disease last year, if you didn't have insurance, you now had a pre-existing condition, you weren't going to be able to access insurance, and you weren't going to be able to access the care needed. And furthermore, even if you had insurance, there's a good chance there is an annual limit or a lifetime limit, and you'd end up without the care you need in that case as well." She said, "We have so much peace of mind that now our loved ones who are struck by this expensive and enigmatic disease are going to get the care they need." And that's really what this is all about, that folks are able to get the care they need. Now, the context of the bill, the structure of the bill is clear. It's titled the Affordable Care Act. It's not titled the Unaffordable Care Act, which would be exactly what it would be if you required people to get insurance, but you didn't provide credits to make it affordable. And that would simply just make no sense. CBO cost estimates were all based upon the idea that these credits were available. The discussions that we held here on Capitol Hill were all based on everyone having these credits available. That is, the state would have the first chance to set up the exchanges. They didn't do it. The federal government would do it for them. So in every possible way, it would be an absurd outcome for the court to strike down these credits. And it'd be catastrophic. Not just absurd, but catastrophic. The millions of folks who would lose their credits would turn into millions of folks who would be without health care. Instead of affordable, accessible health care, we'd have unaffordable, unaccessible health care right back where we were before we put this act into place. It would not be good for Americans to have unaffordable access, that is, without credits. It would not be good for Americans to be without health insurance. And for all those who are championing this outcome, why would someone champion millions of Americans getting thrown off access to health care? And furthermore, everyone else who might retain access to health care is going to see higher health care rates, because we would then have far more uninsured going to our medical facilities as we had before, with those costs being transferred back onto the insured population. It matters that through the Affordable Care Act, we have slowed down the rate of health care inflation substantially to the lowest rate in decades. That benefits everyone. So the ACA is working. The structure of the bill is clear. It's about affordable health care, not about forcing people to get health care they can't afford, and certainly be catastrophic if the court struck down these tax credits. And I'll turn this over to Senator Schumer.
Thank you. Well, thank you, Jeff. And Jeff Merkley's been a tremendous fighter for making sure that ACA works in Oregon and for preserving ACA throughout the whole country, and we really thank him for his voice. Senator Murphy's been the leader in our Democratic caucus in talking about the good of the Affordable Care Act, and thank him as well. So my colleagues have said this all so well, I'm just going to make a brief couple of points on the eve of oral arguments in this crucial case. First, Congress's intent in drafting the ACA is crystal clear. We absolutely intended for all Americans to have access to affordable health insurance, regardless of whether they live in a state using the federal exchange or a state that set up its own. Authors of the ACA never intended for state boundaries to become fences, with those on one side of the fence getting subsidies and those on the other left without them. Second, the ACA works plain and simple. In my state of New York, 400,000 people have signed up on the exchange. 1.4 million have access to quality care through Medicaid. Third, if the Supreme Court rules the wrong way, it would be devastating to millions of families, many of whom have benefited under the law. It would do nothing short of throwing our nation's health care system into chaos. If the plaintiffs get their way, millions of middle-class Americans will be facing a heavy tax care hike, which would wreak havoc on their family finances. And last but not least, these so-called plans that are being rushed out to influence the court are not worth the paper they're printed on. In recent days, we've seen a flurry of op-eds from those opposed to ACA, sketching the outlines of so-called replacements with the promise of future plans to come. But let me say, an op-ed is not a plan. Even if these opponents were able to follow through on their promise to introduce these plans, they'd fall woefully short of anything that could be called a replacement. None of these op-eds make a serious attempt to explain how they would credibly prevent health care tax hikes on middle-class families, stop premiums from spiking, or restore consumer protections that keep insurance companies from discriminating against the sick. If you have a kid with cancer, can the insurance company cut you off under these plans? We have no way of knowing. Even if the plans could be actually drafted and introduced as a bill, there's no guarantee they'd come close to passing. And so, the opponents can't even agree to keep our Homeland Security funded for 3 weeks while ISA and Al-Shabaab are threatening the U.S. How are we supposed to believe they can come together to pass a health care replacement plan with all the diversity in the Republican caucus? So the bottom line is this. Our intent was clear. Every American should have affordable health insurance, and the Affordable Care Act is working. With that, I'm going to do two things. First, I'm going to have to excuse myself and turn over the questions to my very capable colleagues, Senator Merkley and Senator Murphy. But first, I'm going to turn it over to Topher Spiro, the Vice President of Health Policy at the Center for American Progress. Thanks for listening. Thanks for all of my colleagues for getting on. Topher, it's yours.
Thank you, Senator. So unlike the individual mandate case, which presented a constitutional question where there are some gray areas, this case is about statutory interpretation. It's pretty straightforward. And unlike the individual mandate case, this lawsuit is frivolous. Now, opponents of the law argue that the real-world consequences do not matter, and that the only thing that matters is what the statute says. But the real-world consequences should help the court interpret what the statute says. So let me quickly review these real-world consequences. With this year's successful open enrollment, we estimate that now about 7.7 million people are receiving tax credits who would lose them. But it's critically important to understand that it's not only these people who would be affected. Without tax credits, healthier people would be more likely to drop out of the market, so the insurance pool would become sicker and costlier. According to the nonpartisan RAND Corporation, even those people who do not get tax credits would see a premium increase of 47%, leading to a near-death spiral of the market. All told, RAND estimates that more than 9 million people would lose health coverage because of an adverse Supreme Court decision, and many of these people are receiving life-saving treatment they could not otherwise afford. Hospitals would have fewer customers and therefore less revenue, while their cost of uncompensated care would surge. And over 5 million children who are covered by the Children's Health Insurance Program in federal exchange states would be at risk of becoming uninsured. That's because if CHIP expires on schedule or is underfunded, those children would have nowhere to go. It's telling that all the major stakeholders across the healthcare industry, insurance companies, hospitals, advocates for children, filed amicus briefs against this lawsuit, while on the other side, you only have conservative activists. So these real-world consequences are at odds with the statutory text and structure. First, the text clearly indicates quality health care for all Americans, not just Americans who live in states that set up their own exchanges. To prevent a death spiral, the statutory design consists of three fundamental pillars: the individual mandate, insurance reforms, and subsidies. The individual mandate is national in scope. The insurance reforms are national in scope. And so, of course, it makes sense that the subsidies are national in scope as well. Last, Congress provided for a federal exchange as a backup if states do not set up their own exchanges. And the statute clearly states that the federal exchange would take the place of a state exchange and be its functional equivalent in every way. Now consider the absurdity of the challenger's interpretation. Under their interpretation, Congress provided for a federal exchange for no purpose, because without tax credits, it would have no customers. That is nonsensical. Under their interpretation, Congress intended to threaten states that did not set up their own exchanges with market death spirals without clearly communicating this threat. And for the court to rule in their favor, it would have to conclude that their absurd interpretation is the only possible interpretation. Many Americans, especially those who will lose their coverage, would see such a decision for what it would be: politically motivated judicial activism. Thank you.
Chris Murphy again. I don't know if we're moderating questions or not, but we'd be happy to take any questions.
Okay, certainly. And ladies and gentlemen, if you wish to ask a question, press star then one on your touch-tone phone. You'll hear a tone indicating you've been placed in queue. You may remove yourself from queue at any time by pressing the pound key. Again, if you have a question, it's star one at this time. One moment, please, for the first question. Comes from the line of Paul Kane of Washington Post. Please go ahead.
Hi, this is for Senator Murphy or Merkley. Is this the sort of thing that the fight is essentially down to a few words, six words or so? Is this the sort of thing that in a different era we simply would have had a follow-up corrections bill or something to this that, you know, often happens, or at least used to happen, for highway bills and those sort of things, and it's just an era in which this issue also is just so hyper-partisan that you can't go back to it?
This is Chris Murphy. This introduced, because the plaintiffs have focused in on one line in the bill. The entirety of the bill tells only one story, that the subsidies must exist on federal and state-based exchanges in order for the law to work. And as Topher said, in fact, the statute says that. The statute very clearly says that if a state chooses not to move forward with their own exchange, the federal exchange will be defined as the state exchange for the statute's purposes. And so we don't believe that the statute is incorrectly worded. We don't concede any portion of the plaintiff's argument. Thus, there's no reason to come back and amend this. I don't think there are many members of Congress who saw this coming as a problem. If the Supreme Court wants to simply become a quasi-legislative body, there is very little that we can do to stop that. This statute is clear on its face, and if John Roberts and the conservative jurists just want to be in the business of imposing their political judgment for us, then there's nothing that we can do legislatively to stop that.
Okay, thank you. And the next question is from the line of Dan Friedman of Hearst Newspapers. Please go ahead.
Hi, for Senator Murphy. There's a lot of talk about debt spiral in the states that don't have exchanges. But if the Supreme Court were to rule in favor of the plaintiffs, what do you think the impact would be on Connecticut or New York or states that do have exchanges? Would they be in a similar debt spiral, or would they, do you think, continue onward unaffected?
I think that states like Connecticut could survive, but unfortunately we represent the minority of states across the nation. So, Connecticut has been a model from the very beginning. We have the best exchange, best run exchange in the country, and I don't see anything out of this ruling which would invalidate exchanges in states like Connecticut. But clearly, we're here, not just to represent our states, but to represent all the other people across the country who are going to be, greatly harmed by an adverse ruling.
Okay, thank you. And again, if you have a question, star one. You have a question from the line of Paige Cunningham of Washington Examiner. Please go ahead.
Hi, thanks for holding this call. Senator Schumer mentioned earlier that he has many objections to the sort of plans or proposals that Republicans are sort of rolling out now. But I'm wondering, if the court was to block the subsidies, do you envision any scenario under which you think Democrats and Republicans could work on some kind of plan to tie people over?
I'll let Jeff take a crack at this as well. I don't. I mean, I think Senator Schumer said, this Republican Congress can't even, keep the Department of Homeland Security operating for more than a week at a time. There doesn't seem to be, any ability for, this Congress thus far in the first 2 months to even perform the basic legislative functions required of a democracy, never mind try to repair a statute in the wake of an activist Supreme Court decision. So I don't think there's any 2 months of this Congress that should be an advertisement to this court that this could be easily fixed.
I'll simply add that if you set through the torturous process to establish the ACA to begin with, you look at the hyper partisanship and lack of common sense of the leadership now in the House and the Senate, it does not bode well for the possibility of having some substitute. I think we have a law that's working very well, that millions of Americans have embraced. structure of the law is about affordable care. The vision by everyone who was in the discussion was about the credits being available at either state or state exchanges hosted by the state or state exchanges hosted by the federal government. It would be catastrophic. There is no, if the court produces a flawed decision in King versus Burwell, there's no easy fix.
Okay, thank you. And the final question for today comes from the line of Rachel Karras of Inside Health Policy. Please go ahead.
Hi, everybody. Thanks for having this call. You know, and correct me if I'm wrong, but there was a Scottish case last week that ruled that a law should be taken in context rather than its plain meaning of its, I believe, regarding a fisherman and discarding of old fish, and again, correct me if I'm wrong. How do you think that could affect the ways that they come down in King Burwell? And I guess that's for anybody.
I don't know that case, but again, we are not conceding any part of the plaintiff's argument. We think the plain language of the statute, in fact, I'm confident the plain language of the statute is absolutely clear. Not only do you have this specific provision that explicitly states that states that run exchanges through the federal government will have those exchanges deemed as their state exchange, you also have an entire construct of the statute which can only work if the federal government provides exchanges on both types of provides subsidies on both types of exchanges. So, I don't think you have to read the statute in whole in order to interpret the line that is at the heart of the plaintiff's argument. You just have to read the other parts of the statute that talk about what happens if a state chooses not to run its own exchange in order to understand that they then get deemed as state-run